Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's program, co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club of California and the California Healthcare Foundation, in association with the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society, the University of California San Francisco Center for Health and Community, and the San Francisco Department of Public Health's African American Health Initiative, and is brought to you from Fort Mason Center, a national historic landmark on the San Francisco waterfront. We also welcome the listeners of the Commonwealth Club Radio Network joining us for today's program. I am Watson Letch, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'm particularly happy to be here tonight because I am on the board of Children's Hospital Oakland and chairman of Children's Hospital Oakland's Research Institute, and African American health is very central to our missions. In fact, we have the country's largest clinical and research program in sickle cell disease. And also, as a Berkeley professor, I spent a lot of time at Tuskegee Institute, so I'm particularly interested in the program this evening. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge a distinguished member of our audience. We are honored to welcome Grantlyn Johnson, Secretary of the California Health and Human Services Agency. Welcome. Now it is my pleasure to welcome to the podium Alfred Williams, President of the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society, based here at Fort Mason Center. Mr. Williams will introduce our distinguished keynote speaker, Dr. Alvin Poussant. Following Dr. Poussant's remarks, a panel of experts will discuss African Americans' healthcare and medical research from their professional perspective. The panel will be moderated by Dr. Eugene Washington, Director of University of California San Francisco's Medical Effectiveness Research Center for Diverse Populations and a member of the California Healthcare Foundation Board of Directors. Now, Alfred Williams.
Thank you, Watson. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society, welcome to Fort Mason Center. For more than 45 years, the Society has provided fora for the discussion of issues of importance to the African American community and the general public. Today's program continues that tradition. Before introducing our keynote speaker, I'd like to thank each of the organizations Watson mentioned that have sponsored this program. I'd also like to thank the representatives of those organizations who brought this program to life. These are people you will see later at the reception, but I wanted to mention them here because they worked hard in making this event the success that we know it will be this evening. Those persons include Margaret Lyon of the California Healthcare Foundation, Gina Keel of the Commonwealth Club, Nancy Adler of UCSF's Center for Health and Community, Dr. Eugene Washington of UCSF's Medical Effectiveness Research Center for Diverse Populations, and Cynthia Selmar of the San Francisco Public Health Department's African American Health Initiative. I'd also like to acknowledge the presence today of three other people. Peter Buxton. Mr. Buxton is the person who almost single-handedly brought the Tuskegee syphilis experiments to a halt. Tony Hooker, the creator of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment exhibit that is on display in the Society's museum through January 6th, and Noah Griffin, who brought Peter, Tony, and the Society together. Noah also wrote a poem in connection with the exhibit. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker. Dr. Alvin Poussant is an author, psychiatrist, educator, and respected social critic. He's an expert on the dynamics of race relations and of prejudice in America's increasingly multicultural society. During his long and illustrious career, Dr. Poussant helped desegregate hospitals and health facilities in the South. He directed a psychiatric program and a low-income housing project, and he served as a script consultant to The Cosby Show, one of the most popular and groundbreaking television shows ever. Born in East Harlem, Dr. Poussant attended Columbia University and received his MD from Cornell. He received his psychiatric training at UCLA. Currently, Dr. Poussant serves as a director of the Media Center of the Judge Baker Children's Center in Boston and has provided consultation to government agencies, corporations, and the media. He is Professor of Psychiatry and Faculty Associate Dean for Student Affairs at Harvard Medical School, where he sits on the board of Harvard's AIDS Institute. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Poussaint is an author. In 1992, he co-authored Raising Black Children with Dr. James Comer. His latest book, Lay My Burden Down, was published last year. According to a recent review of Lay My Burden Down, Dr. Poussaint and his co-author, Amy Alexander, make a strong case for a type of post-traumatic slavery symptom stressor resulting in a dehumanization of the human spirit, the emasculation of black males, and its judgmental health care delivery, and a distrust of white society and its judgmental health care delivery. In selecting a keynote speaker, the sponsors of this program were committed to finding a person whose experience and expertise would enable him or her to discuss the issues raised by the Tuskegee syphilis experiment in the context of contemporary healthcare issues facing African Americans. We all agreed that Alvin Poussaint would be an excellent choice to provide an important, thought-provoking perspective on these issues. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Alvin Poussaint.
I may throw it at somebody, you know, and lose my temper up here. And he's right in front of me. He did the first banging, so. Anyway, it's good to be here all the way from Boston, Massachusetts. When I got here today, and San Francisco is always so familiar. And a lot of you people are from UCSF and surrounding programs, and there's a lot of kind of traffic back and forth between UCSF and their medical center and Harvard Medical School, as you know. The dean of Harvard Medical School we stole from UCSF, Joe Mott. Is now the dean. We took him. We also stole another dean, Dan Lowenstein, who's now at Harvard. You didn't steal. They didn't steal any people back yet. So we're waiting to see what they're going to do. Anyway, one of the people we stole, Dan Lowenstein, in fact, was director of a lot of the multicultural programs and diversity at UCSF. So you see, we need him in Boston because we don't have many people interested in that kind of thing. Or there's a lot of resistance to it, believe it or not, all over the place. I mean, some, you know, we kind of have an idealized notion of doctors and of psychiatrists. We somehow don't think or feel that they're prejudiced in the same way that other people are. But I'll tell you, it was an awakening for me right through medical school training. And then right through psychiatric training at UCLA, all the overt kind of racism. I mean, it wasn't secret. I mean, it was out. A lot of it was out in the open with in people's attitudes. And then institutionalized racism. I was at UCLA for 4 years in psychiatric training. And I was trying to see black patients. No black patients were coming to UCLA, and no Latinos. So I went to the outpatient department. I said, I want some black patients. So finally, after a number of weeks, they found a black patient who was a graduate student at UCLA. So they sent him to see me, and he walked into the office, and he looked at me. He said, what's going on here? Are they practicing some kind of segregation? So I got upset. He said he was going to go complain about it. How? He said, what were the chances of getting me? I was the only one in the whole institute of his getting me. So he thought they were matching us up. So he wanted to go argue about it. I said, no, don't do that. Don't do that. I need to see some black people. So he did stay with me, you know. But that was it shows you, even in a place that was as diverse as Los Angeles, what happened. So, you know, I finished my training. After I finished my training, every time something happened in the black community, you know, they riot or do something, they would come running to me and they say, Dr. Poussin, what do black people think about that? I said, I don't know. I haven't seen any. So that institution, and you know one of the answers to that, and it's all, you know, fits into this, there was a psychiatrist there who's now deceased, who died young, named J. Alfred Cannon, who was 2 years ahead of me. He was black, and he set up one of the first community health centers in Los Angeles in the black community. But before he did that, because we were not seeing any black patients over at UCLA's outpatient apartment, we hooked up with a minister in the black community over in the Watts South Side area, and worked out a plan where we would hold clinic there two nights a week, a mental health clinic in the church. And he set up the basement, and people came. We opened and they came. And the reason why they were not coming to UCLA, it was a far away, no one welcomed them and so on, and they felt safe within the church, and this was also being endorsed by the minister. It was my first example about how you have to hook up and collaborate with people to do things in innovative ways, and it's very doable, except a lot of us don't like to go away from our centers and habitats to go out to help people on their own turf. Part of the title of my talk tonight is The Legacy of Tuskegee and Healthcare for African Americans and so on. Let me just say straight out that Tuskegee study, if you compared it itself in terms of its importance or the gravity of its horror, I don't know if it would rank that high. You have to think about all the other things that they have done to black people. I mean, just, it was part of what they did. If you go back and just look at slavery, I mean, they reports say that before they got the slaves on the ship, maybe 50% of them died from violence and all kind of things. You put them on a ship, about almost another 30 to 50% died from all kinds. You put them in all those kinds of the diseases and so on, they were dying. And then they brought them here to the United States, and then they were exposed to talk about Tuskegee study and syphilis. The Africans didn't have any syphilis. They got it when they came to America from the Europeans. You see, so they started getting, plus they brought other things like yellow fever, malaria. So the question of there not being any health care and disease and trauma and death from disease and from neglect, I mean, it's just enormous. I mean, it's not even fathomable. I mean, we we're into some kind of denial, you know, like when they said Jefferson, you know, had this slave woman that he, you know, was his honey and stuff like that and had children. People say, oh, no, that couldn't, oh, no, no, no. I mean, give me a break. I mean, you know, probably all those white men slept with black women. What black women had no rights. If they wanted it, they took it. You understand? We are not these different colors because of anything black men were doing with white women. Right? We are all these different colors mainly because of that. And that was exploitive, abusive, and it was rape. But just think, one of the questions that I think affects, you know, healthcare. Let's put it another way. What was your life worth as a slave? What was your life worth after slavery during institutionalized Jim Crow segregation in the South for another 100 years? I mean, by definition, black lives were not worth very much in comparison to white life. So there's two-fifths of a man or a woman, but worse with the woman in terms of counting in a lot of ways. So our lives didn't count very much. Now, if you just take that and look even in terms of the civil rights struggle, it's been to make our lives count as much as a white life in America. And this affects other minority groups, too. And you can ask yourself the question right now to yourself. See what kind of... Do you think a black life in America counts as much as a white life? And then look at all the institutions and how they function in relationships to blacks. That there's evidence after evidence after evidence. The criminal justice system isn't fair. Anybody who investigates that tells you. The death penalty... Back the first time, before they stopped it later on, every man electrocuted in the electric chair for rape was a black man. And it was for so-called raping a white woman. White men didn't go into the electric chair for raping black women because what they did with black women was not rape. That wasn't illegal. And then white men didn't go to the chair either if for raping black women, but also if they did go to the chair or get the death penalty, it was always the victims always have to be white. And that's still a pattern today in the criminal justice system, not to mention all of the inequities in sentencing, the cocaine with the crack, and the fact that studies show that for black men who commit the same crimes as the white man, they get stronger sentences. So look at any institution. Now look at health. Now the bottom line for racism is what? We just remind ourselves: racism, unharnessed, is genocidal. Now we have to all know that's what's been going on all around the world in different countries. Is genocidal. If it's ethnic conflict and it has a form of that racism, it's genocidal. You want to get rid of the people you're victimizing, and you want to get rid of them genetically, whatever that means. So when you're genocidal, you don't care anything about the lives of those people. And there's no sparing. Everybody says, well, women and children are hurting, they're killing women. Of course they are, because they want to obliterate the group. That's what genocide is all about. And so a child's life is not worth anything either. A baby's life is not worth anything. And during the My Lai massacre in the Vietnam War with United States troops, that came out. When they had did the massacre and they came back and they had hearings, and they asked the soldiers, well, you know, we can understand why you killed the women because maybe they were soldiers. We can understand why you killed the older people. Maybe they had arms and were helping the Viet Cong. They said, but why did you shoot and kill the babies? And the soldiers, kind of paraphrasing soldiers, said, well, a little gook grows up to be a big gook. So you kill him now. You see, that's it. And it didn't feel a contradiction. So everyone's capable, and the United States people were shocked. We shouldn't be shocked. We know what racism is in America and how it's practiced. But look, if the premise is that racism has components in it that are genocidal, and then look at the healthcare system, wouldn't you expect, just like in a criminal justice system, it would be expressed in a healthcare system in terms of the value of your life? The value of your life? And that in health care, medicine, it's a life-death matter. So if they give you lousy care or no care at all, you're more likely to die. You see, that's the element, you see, that's similar to someone just murdering people, but it's by commission and omission or just not caring that then becomes institutionalized in the system. Now, talking about doctors. Well, let's realize that the healthcare system basically, except for a small bit, were controlled by white physicians. in this country historically. Okay? That means all the attitudes they had toward blacks were being played out in different kinds of ways. And they were part of the group, many of them, in fact, who preached the inferiority of black people. Physicians were in on that, too. I mean, one of the whole weird things with Tuskegee study, they had all these strange notions about potential genetic differences in blacks and whites that was going to make the syphilis maybe more virulent, and they had to see the natural course of disease. They had all kinds of notions about differences based on race, a lot of them stereotypes. And it always used to puzzle them that blacks didn't have, black suicide rate is only one half the white rate. But I don't know if I believe that. And they say this goes back to slavery and after slavery and so on, because they had a reason to keep the suicide rate down for black people, because it would look like slavery was benign. Do you understand what I'm saying? That slavery wasn't so bad. Look, black people wouldn't then kill themselves. And some of them used this argument when they were fighting to maintain segregation. They said, you get those black people get in the mainstream, their suicide rate's going to go up. You don't want that to happen. So this is like the best of possible worlds for these folks. So now let's go back to the 1850s, because I think it plants a seed of what I think is a profound thing we all have to understand about all of this. And that's the story of Dr. Cartwright, Dr. Samuel Cartwright, who was called to a plantation in the late 1840s in Louisiana because slaves were running away from the plantation to freedom and escaping to the north. And this slave owner was upset because he was losing his property and his profits. So he called in Dr. Cartwright, who kind of was a surgeon who doubled as a psychologist and had a big rep for understanding black folks, right? So they call him in for his expertise. I mean, we have people like that still today who can, you know, become experts. You have to watch what their perspective is and how they're coming at it. But he came down and he did what the social sciences would do today. He talked to everybody, the slaves, the overseers, and everybody in plantation. And then he wrote a long paper. The paper was published in the New Orleans Medical Society Journal in 1851, a long scholarly paper. And I have it in my files, the whole paper in my file. You can click from the journal. In the paper, Dr. Cartwright concluded that the slaves who were running away from the plantation to the north were suffering from a mental disease, which he called dreptomania, which means runaway mania. And then he said other slaves were suffering from another mental illness because they were belligerent. Right? Now think of what he's saying. That, I mean, it seems, it sounds far-fetched and wild now, but actually, in his context, it was normative kind of response. What he was saying was that slavery was the best of possible worlds, and deviations from even the slaves wanting to get away from slavery was psychopathology. Now, remember that, whatever your perspective is and whichever you're defining, and then what you define as psychopathology has to do with a lot of perspectives. It's not a hard science. So he was saying that, and it was a way also of legitimizing slavery, and also making all the slave owners feel that slaves who ran away were crazy, so they were doing the right thing and keeping them, chaining them, and all kinds of other things, and brutalizing them, right? It legitimized. Then I know there were some black people who were indoctrinated too, because black people hear the lie that they're inferior and so on and so forth. So I bet back during those times, after Cartwright gave his paper, that when some slaves were trying to run away, there were other slaves saying, what are you trying to do? You stay here. What are you, crazy? Stay on the plantation. because they get indoctrinated too. And that's still one of the issues today if we look at the experience that we've been through psychologically. If you look at the experience psychologically we've been through, just close your eyes and appreciate for that for 250 years of slavery, the constant indoctrination was that black people were inferior. They were subhuman. 250 years of that. And then another 100 of Jim Crow segregation legalized and accepted by the United States government doing the same thing. 350 years. Ask a rhetorical question. How long does it take to get over that experience? And the same question you can ask, how long does it take to make up for the inequities and the disparities in health care for black Americans that started way back during slavery, in which some public health researchers at Harvard who are black have called the slave health deficit, that you can trace it all the way back. I mean, Tuskegee study, they were doing experiments on black people all the time. Because they saw black people as being available for that. And they weren't just doing it in the South, they were doing it in New York and all over the country. We have this informed consent. Informed consent is relatively recent. That's like maybe 40 years old, 1960s. Informed consent, where you tell the patient you're doing research. Before then, you came in the hospital and they did what they wanted. And Fannie Lou Hamer used to be used to talk about the Mississippi appendectomy, which was a sterilization procedure. They would take out black women's uterus and so on without even asking them. They did all kinds of research on, a lot of it probably unpublished or published places, and people dig it up. They did things like try to bury people and all kinds of things. There was a study I discovered in 1963 in Texas where they took black babies and decided to see what effect withholding one of the essential fatty acids from their formula would have on them. And their skin got all scaly and all kinds of things. Even a number of them died. What's weird thing is they had done this study before on dogs, and then decided to see if they can do it on human beings. Now, one thing you have to know, that in terms of ethics, morality, in the medical world, you never do research where the outcome you're looking for is supposed to be negative, is supposed to be harm to the subjects you're researching. That is always bad research. That's why a Tuskegee study was bad research on the face of it ethically, because people were being harmed by it. You can't do research in that way. But before informed consent, people did what they wanted, and that was the way it is. So black people coming from this tradition, let's take a look at it. Until 1965, 1966, hospitals were officially health facilities segregated throughout the South. And their own way, they were segregated in the major cities by neighborhoods and so on. And blacks used to go to the public hospitals, you know, and so on, and that's where they went. In New York, they went to Harlem Hospital. Even though you had Cornell and Columbia sitting up there with those mansions, they went to Harlem Hospital. And blacks then became afraid of their own hospitals because they thought they weren't as good as the other ones, or they had broken down buildings and all kinds of things. So it gets very, very complex. But segregation, this segregated medicine is an oxymoron. It doesn't even make sense to say you have segregated medicine. Because segregated medicine meant that black people were getting no care or inferior care. And let me tell you something about the mentality, because it would blow my mind. When I was working in Mississippi for about 2 years, and one of my jobs was to deal with getting places desegregated, the hospitals. And I would go into the hospital to talk to the white chief officer, the doctors, to tell them we're here to see they have to start desegregating because the laws had been passed. But they weren't desegregating, even though the laws had been passed. They were going to keep it that way. And I would go in, and they would invite me in. They were very nice to me, offer me coffee and cookies and stuff. And we would... We would sit down and talk. And what it would amount to, this doctor being very nice to me running the hospital, was to try to convince me that the best care, that the black people got the best care that they could get under segregated medicine, and that it was actually good for them, this system of care. Now, you can walk on wards, and you could see the black side with the peeling paint and the broken equipment and the torn blankets and the unswept floors and a little bit of staff because they were all on the white side. And you knew that people were dying because of segregated medicine. They were dying. And if you happened to be in an area where the hospital was all white, which was also against the law, they were supposed to have segregated stuff. Some of the... They designated some hospitals all white, and if you came there, let me tell you, they did not take you in. And that's one of the reasons why you had a lot of black folk healers all over the South, root healers and the midwives, because if a black woman came to a white hospital, say in Yazoo City, Mississippi, which is about, I don't know, 50 miles or something from Jackson, that was an all-white hospital, and they wouldn't take them. So either they had to have midwives to deliver them, or they had their babies in cars or trucks trying to get down to Jackson to get to the segregated hospital in Jackson. So that, think in terms of segregation in medicine, that you had to, every time you went in for care, you had to trade your dignity and reinforce the image inside of yourself that you were worth less as a person compared to a white person every time you made that exchange. And then what did you think or what would you feel about how that doctor who practiced segregation valued your life? Now, let me tell you, it was not from some activist movement on a part of white doctors realizing that they were en masse violating the Hippocratic Oath. It should have been the hypocritical oath for them. But they were violent. There was no mass uprising, and they're saying, this is awful, and this is killing people, and people are dying because of this. We have to change. It didn't come from doctors. It didn't come from the American Medical Association. The American Medical Association would not force and push the Mississippi Medical Society, which was part of the AMA, to take black doctors. They wouldn't do it. They kept saying, our chapters have autonomy. Autonomy to practice segregation and to let people die and be sick. See, it didn't come from them, and I think that's what we have to know. Because we're talking 35 years ago. It didn't come from organized medicine. It didn't come from the doctors in the South. There were doctors around who joined the movement, but it wasn't because of doctors, it was because of the law and the civil rights movement that it's changed. But it wasn't even high, and we have to ask ourselves some questions about this. Why wasn't health care, segregated health care, high on the agenda of the civil rights organizations? It was not. They had lunch counter. They had voting, which is very important. They had education. But they didn't have a critical life-death issue on the agenda. None of them did. SCLC, SNCC, CORE, NAACP, they did not have it high on the agenda. And I can't figure it out. Is it because it's less glamorous? Have you ever seen the civil rights organizations picket and demonstrate against a segregated hospital in the South or in Mississippi? You never see it. So what does that say about where it all fits with us? And isn't that, does that have something to do with some of the disparities we have now because we have not been activist enough around healthcare issues and have been too passive in relationship to the kind of services we get or that we receive? Now, let me go back and tell you another story. My psychiatric colleagues had an all-white facility, too, and they wouldn't admit black patients. So I was trying the old technique of being a nice Negro, and they would see that I was such a nice Negro, they would let blacks into the facility. So I would go over there and give grand rounds and smile and stuff, you know, and all this stuff. And all these people would like me. He's an intelligent Negro guy. And, well, of course, that doesn't work, right? I mean, that's simple-minded. But a lot of us used to do that in the past, that we would set an example. We would go someplace as the one person and show that we were so wonderful that they would just love black, all black people. Well, it doesn't work that way. Anyway, they didn't want to, after all of this, it came time for them to desegregate the psychiatric unit. And they sat around and had meetings, the social work and psychiatrists, and then held kind of a press conference and said they believed in democracy and equality, but they felt that to desegregate their psychiatric unit at this time would be detrimental to the mental health of both blacks and whites. Sound like Dr. Cartwright, don't they? Huh? 1965, it sounds like Dr. Cartwright. So it ain't an academic discussion. You don't get an academic discussion with Dr. Cartwright. You say this man is a racist fool and he's your enemy. And he's trying to do harm to you, and there's no reason to be sitting down having nice discussions with someone who's doing harm to you very actively. Well, that's the same with the Mississippi psychiatrist at the hospital, because what did their position mean? It meant that they took a position that would maintain the status quo. They still weren't going to accept black people because they were concerned about their mental health, which is bizarre. And just twist it. But that was the argument they used. So the law came in again, and we sent in complaints, and they were threatened with having their federal money taken away because they were still an all-white hospital, and they started admitting black patients, and we monitored them. But I'll give you a little puzzle. You'll figure it out. I'm not going to give you the answer. After we monitored them for about 6 months, we found they were admitting black patients in token fashion. And all of the black patients they admitted were black women. Now, you're to figure out why they were not admitting black men to the psychiatric unit at this hospital in Mississippi when it first was desegregated. Another story I want to tell you, I think it's very, very important one, that describes difficulties in terms of the black community and in terms of seeking out and trusting the healthcare establishment, that was much more profound than the Tuskegee study itself. Even the Tuskegee study, because it got a lot of publicity, added some fuel to that. But it's a whole experience we've had as a people with the healthcare system. Well, anyway, there was a hospital up going toward the Delta in Mississippi that we really went after because it was just boldly segregated with white and colored signs still up. So we got the federal people the things you had to do and got the signs taken down, and the hospital was supposed to desegregate, and it wouldn't be a separate colored and white waiting room and so on and so forth. Well, we went back about 3 or 4 months later, and we walked into the hospital to the waiting room, and what do you think we saw? all the black people were still sitting on the color side, and all the white people were still sitting on the white side. There were no signs up. So we waited outside, and we grabbed some of the black patients as they came out. And we said, you know, you don't have to sit on the color side anymore. You can sit anywhere you want. And they looked at me as if I was insane. Like, what are you talking about? Now, they were right. See, they were right. And here's the way they explained it. They said, you see that God over there? The God? Security God? They said, you think he changed his attitudes since the signs were taken down? And then they said, do you think the doctors and nurses have changed their attitude and now are not racist because the signs are taken down? They said they didn't think so. And that they felt that if they sat on the white side, the white doctors and nurses would retaliate against them by not giving them health care or letting them die. That's what they said. Now, you count that experience all over. And there's people today who don't want to go to hospitals because they think people are going to let them die or people are going to do research on them. I got an older sister. I can't get her to doctors. Every time she go to a doctor, she's worried about research being done on her. They give her a pill, and she calls me up and says, is this some experimental medicine they give me? You know, everything, because the distrust goes very, 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 very deep because of a host of experiences, not the Tuskegee study, and because a lot of black people know and sense they didn't get good health care. They knew they couldn't become doctors and all kinds of things. And then even in major cities, they got the worst of the health care. You know, so we talk about cultural competence now. You know, people complain about, you know, things that happen. Some people say, like, the cultural competence, why don't you just teach them to be nice? You know what I mean? Because you go to a lot of places and people don't act very friendly. And if you're poor and you're minorities, they may act even less friendly because there's power relationships that exist. And so part of the cultural competence is getting rid of some of the unconscious or conscious negative attitudes that healthcare personnel have toward minorities and poor people. Same way they may have them toward the homeless. And doctors, if you talk to doctors, they will tell you, they will always tell you, the ones in Mississippi didn't think they were prejudiced, no matter what they're doing. Some knew they were segregationists. But they're going to tell you they're treating everybody the same. But if you do research, you find they're not treating everybody the same. If you take videos, you see they're not treating everybody the same. Some people they say hello to and good morning, and some people they don't. And some people they shake their hand, and some people they don't. And some people they say, take a chair right over there, I'll be right with you, and some people they don't. And then there's all kinds of body language. Facial expressions, right? And so people pick these things up, and black people got long antennas. And they have more than their share of distrust. Or maybe that's not the right way to say it. Maybe they have the proper share of distrust. And they have paranoia. You know, black people are overdiagnosed for paranoia. In mental health clinics, because I mean, you black man, black women, you walk in and you start acting suspicious because you think you should be suspicious, and they say suspicious. Paranoid, and then if you start asking provocative questions, they put down paranoid, hostile. I mean, you start getting the stuff. And that's a neat one, like paranoid, schizophrenic, because that's they can still involuntarily hospitalize you much more easily. You see what I mean? Now, we're underdiagnosed for depression. And I read papers a long time ago where they were saying black people don't get depressed as much as white people and everything. And in one of the discussions of the paper, one of the doctors speculated it was because we were happy-go-lucky people. And that's a true stereotype, that we're happy. And everything just rolls off and we don't get depressed. Well, it's interesting, black people don't think they're depressed either. If you ask them if depression is a health problem, vast majority say no. They don't see depression as a health problem or as an illness. Well, figure they don't consider it an illness, but black people invented the blues. Now, that's an interesting cultural kind of twist, isn't it? They felt they were born to suffer. So if you think nobody knows the trouble I've seen, nobody knows my sorrow, and that's the way it is, your whole scale for misery, your misery index is different than the misery index for, say, a typical white person, right? So you may not consider that to be something that's, quote, an illness or a disorder. But blacks suffered from a lot of depression. Another thing, you want to see the legacies of Tuskegee or distrust. 70% of black patients who are depressed say that if a doctor gave them antidepressant medications to treat their depression, they would not take them. Okay, they wouldn't take them. So all these medicines people giving up, they have to find out why people aren't taking them. Right? And you can explore that. It would be different with different individuals. Some of it will be research. Some of them will see the doctor giving them the medicines as a rejection. You see what I mean? That is, you don't want to bother with me, so you give me these pills, and you're not really listening to what's going on. All kinds of complicated reasons. And then the other problem is, like, psychiatrists and psychologists and people, they're so interested in psychopathology. I mean, people come in, even if they get past it being a stigma, and the psychiatrists are looking for problems. If you don't have any, they will find them anyway. I mean, it's really true. We're trained to look for psychopathology. It's true. And so if the people aren't depressed when they came in, they're depressed when they walk out. Because you're focused on the negative. And then if you're not engaging and you're using those indirect techniques, of dealing with the patient, so you're not that interactive, so the patient's telling you fine, you're just saying, tell me more about that, yeah. Then the hour's over and the patient walks out and says, what's wrong with him? Right? There's a cultural gap, whatever you want to call it, right? And they may interpret that as the doctor being cold and uncaring. You see, so if you want to change how you relate to people, Latinos, you may have to change the whole style of what you think is appropriate ways of interacting with patients, even the mental health professionals. Because it may be inappropriate to the cultural group. But frequently we blame the people if they don't partake of the psychiatry or the psychological things that we have to offer. Remember, too, there's a fear in black people with mental health issues because they know from their experience, black people usually in all the southern states, but even here, even in New York City, when they got psychiatric help, it was usually that they were seriously ill and were sent to state hospitals. They were committed. So black people knew there were two officials in society who could lock you up against your will, cops, and psychiatrists. Right? I mean, we would do outreach when I was working in this public housing development in Boston. You know it, Armando, Columbia Point. We do this outreach, and nurses would go out, and if they found someone when they visit their home who was in emotional distress or depressed or something, they would come back and tell me. And then I would go out with them, and they would bring me into the home to talk to the person. So one day, this nurse brought me over to this black woman's house, said she was distressed and so on, and brought me with her, and she knocked on the door, and the woman said, who's there? And she said, well, so on the nurse, and I have Dr. Poussaint with me. And she said, is he that there psychiatrist? And she said, yes. She said, he ain't coming in here. Now, she was probably had right, because her experience living there, the experience she knew was psychiatrists came around to people and somehow they ended up in a state hospital and you never heard about them again. And she was going to protect herself against that possibility. So I wouldn't come in and find out somehow she's crazy or whatever it is and put her in a state hospital, because outpatient treatment, see, that was such a big area of neglect, particularly when psychiatry was just growing and growing, of serving people. I mean, it's kind of a structural problem was in psychiatry, because psychiatrists all went into private practice and wanted to deal with people who had money so you could pay them. So you got the state hospital where the poor people were neglected. The fancy private hospitals is where you had all of the psychiatrists and the leading psychiatrists. And frequently those populations were white populations, with rare exceptions. So there's another example of institutionalized covering a lot of different areas. I'm going to sit down now. Where's my person who prompts me? Oh, Al's prompting me. Okay. This is just... I'm going to leave for the panel. There's all kinds of disparities in healthcare, but I want to leave for the panel discussion. What do we do about these disparities? What are the issues? What do we have to do? What can our approach be to get rid of the slave deficit? And what do we do about the post-traumatic slavery syndrome? And finally, even homicide is frequently an expression of depression and fatalism, which is high in the black community. And other self-destructive behaviors are frequently an expression of depression and lack of feelings of self-worth. So all of this connects in many, many different ways and is very complicated across institutions, across communities, and within individual people themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Poussaint, for those stimulating remarks and for providing us with such a rich historical context for our discussion. I'm Gene Washington. I'm the director of UCSF Medical Effectiveness Research Center for Diverse Populations, and I'm also a member of the board of directors of the California Healthcare Foundation. It's my pleasure to moderate this panel this evening, and it's also my pleasure to introduce our two panelists, Dr. Patricia Evans and Dr. Lavera Crawley. Dr. Patricia Evans is the medical director of the San Francisco Health Department's program in maternal and child health, and herself was a practicing physician in the African American community for many years. Dr. Lavera Crawley is based at Stanford's Biomedical Ethics Center, and she is the author of a recent report looking at trust, particularly as it relates to medical research. We're going to begin with some comments from Dr. Evans.
Good evening, everyone. Hello. First of all, I really would like to thank the co-sponsors of this presentation, and especially it's a real honor for me to be sitting here next to Dr. Poussaint, who I've read about for many, many years. And I'd also like to thank Mr. Tony Hooker for his his photographic display of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, and such that we could have a discussion here this evening. I was asked actually to address two particular issues around health care and health-seeking behaviors of African-Americans and where do we go from here. And then I also heard from Dr. Poussaint about the health disparities as well, too. But first, I'd like to deal with the first question. And in terms of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, I think we just heard that. I don't really feel that that has been the major piece in terms of why we have our current health-seeking behaviors and also the what we do in terms of society, in terms of our health care. I know in reviewing Bad Blood by James Jones, one of the things that I certainly did note was the fact that in slavery time, we were also considered, as you had mentioned, just plain old property. And that's how we were treated. If the property didn't work well because we were ill, then they called in the doctor. And then the doctor actually went to the slave quarters. They didn't take them out to see the doctor because the doctor didn't want them having it coming into their offices anyway. So they went into the slave quarters. And I think that's something that we really do need to think about as well, too. And so there was this episodic crisis care that has continued, and I still see it even today. Even though, and despite the fact that some of us do have sufficient health care coverage. And so we really do need to think about that, and we need to look at why is that really happening. And we can, you know, we can do all kinds of epidemiological studies to show that it's there, but we really need to start asking the question, why is it happening? And the other issue is this whole thing around fear, and I don't think that the Tuskegee syphilis experiment really was the main thing or the main cause for the fear that we have in terms of the healthcare system. I think Dr. Poussaint really addressed that in his remarks in terms of the historical presentation that he gave this evening. And because even if you look at the Tuskegee syphilis study, one of the things that you do note was that the people there even feared going to the hospitals. So, and at that time, that was considered organized medicine. And, you know, today we have an even larger conglomerate of organized medicine, so we need to look at it in relationship to that. I want to try to address the next issue in terms of where do we go from here. I must say that there are some very important and useful lessons that can be learned from the Tuskegee syphilis study, from that experiment. Even despite the anger that I feel, and I'm sure that many of you feel as well, too, that arises when we think about what happened to those who were involved in that particular study and what was done and not done to them and for them, because that's a big issue that we all have to address. The out-out lies, the deceit, the total disregard for human dignity must never be forgotten. And I think that's one of the things that we have to do as a people is never forget. Because I find too often, you know, we forgive and forget and move on, and we can't continue to do that. And that must be taken into account when we are developing systems that do work for us. What I do suggest is that each one of you obtain a copy of a very interesting paper entitled 20 Years of Follow-Up Experience in a Long-Range Medical Study by Eunice Rivers, who was a public health nurse involved in this particular study that was written in Public Health Reports in 1953. It's a very interesting paper. And she talks about the non-medical aspects of that particular study. But I think that paper could be used to help develop a medical care system and research programs for African Americans and should be looked upon perhaps as a blueprint for the development of these. Although this may anger some of you, because some of you may blame her also in terms of the Tuskegee syphilis study, there's some very good points that are brought up in that paper. And this was a 20-year follow-up, and for me, the most phenomenal thing was that they had an 87% return rate. 87% of the 600 people were able to be followed 20 years down the road. That's amazing to me. And some of the components of that paper that she discusses that I think that some of the things that we need to begin to look at happened to be the first thing that they did was to hire somebody from the community because she was from that community. She knew the community. She knew a lot of those families. The ones that she didn't know in the beginning, she certainly did get to know as well. And the other thing that she did, too, is that she helped to bridge the gap between those researchers. And sometimes even I as a provider can make mistakes in terms of communication with patients. And sometimes somebody needs to interpret what I say to the patient as well, too. And that's exactly what she did. And she also assisted with the development of trust amongst these individuals, that they really trusted her. And then the other thing that was very pertinent was that it was a very holistic approach, because she not only dealt with the individual who was the research subject, but she dealt with the entire family because of her public health background. Recruitment strategies were quite interesting, because these are things that I've been talking about, for example, at the federal level at NIH, where you need to identify key leaders, which they did do, and they identified key black leaders and got them to buy off on that particular study. And then the recruitment also included distribution of flyers and posters and things in the most common places that people went to: churches, community stores, and schools. Isn't that something that we do now? And something that we really do need to consider in terms of healthcare and also research. The other thing that was very important, I think, about this study, too, was the flexibility that was seen. They noted that they could not get these subjects to come back during planting time and harvesting time. So what they did was they went after the men during non-planting and non-harvesting times. They were flexible. And we need to become flexible and understand that we have to be flexible for African Americans in order to serve them appropriately. We have to be willing to go where the individual is. What is so sacrosanct about the clinic, the office, or the hospital that some of the procedures could not be done in the neighborhoods and, in fact, in the homes? Why is it that we always have to go someplace else to receive certain types of care? Does the blood pressure have to be taken only in the office, or can it be taken someplace else? Look at the photographs over there, and you'll see where they were actually drawing bloods and where they were meeting and greeting these men. Another thing, too, is to provide incentives. And one of the things that I have to say is that we need to be very careful with incentives, that incentives need to be given that are enough to keep a person engaged, but not so much that it's going to coerce them to participate in research. Transportation, food, child care, things like that is something that we certainly can offer and we need to think about. We also need to maintain current addresses and a periodic follow-up. I think one of the major things that we all need to do is begin to think outside of the box. Even I find myself, because I was trained at a majority institution, begin to think like the majority. And I need to go back to my roots and figure out what really worked for me. And I think that's what we all need to do, and look at what will work for us. We must stop blaming the patient or research subject and begin to think about our own system failures, because I'd like to think of it, we have failed our patients. We have failed the research subjects when they don't participate. It's a system problem, and that's what we need to look at. It might be the individual, it might be the location, it might be where it's held, it might be the name that is associated with it as well, too. We cannot lump all African Americans into a monolithic culture either, but need to better understand our individual cultural context. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, a Midwestern city. It's a nice place to be from, is what I usually like to say. But I noticed coming out here to California, African Americans here in California were very, very different from those that I grew up with. There are certain similarities, yes, but there are some real differences that are there. And until the majority in this country understands that, number one, we have a culture, and we have multiple cultures amongst African Americans as well, and that has to be accepted and explored. We need to develop a holistic approach to healthcare and research, which is much more culturally relevant, with adequate infrastructure to ensure the viability of this type of approach. We must ensure the development of African American healthcare professionals and researchers. We have to ensure that systems are flexible, tolerant, and respectful of differences in people. Because I'm not the same as this lady here. I'm not the same as you. We're not the same, and we are different, and those have to be accepted. We must ensure appropriate partnering between public health professionals and researchers with African American community-based organizations for health awareness and education and/or treatment options. I think if we do the above, we can make a real difference in terms of our respective communities' health improvement. Thank you very much.
I want to build on what Dr. Evans has just talked about and focus my comments on the implications of the historical events that happened at Tuskegee on medical research, and in particular African-American participation in research. But we can't talk about this subject without considering the impact of that legacy on what Dr. Poussaint raised, and this that whole issue of trust or distrust. Trust is that fundamental aspect of human relationships that allows us to work together towards some common goal. And ideally, in medicine and research, that common goal is the improvement of individual or family or community health. The United States Public Health Service study on untreated syphilis in the Negro male at Tuskegee, it's a mouthful, but get used to that because I'll speak to that in a bit. It's often cited as the paradigm case of abuse in medical research, and then it's deferred to as the source of mistrust among African Americans. And it's thought that this very mistrust is the reason that we don't participate in clinical trials. And the implications of that is significant because, for example, there are many drugs or treatments that are approved without knowledge of the benefits to or the effectiveness in African Americans. So I would like to raise two points. Perhaps they're controversial, but they've been raised now by my fellows here at the table. And I'm hoping that I will, in making these comments, provide a deeper understanding of this relationship of trust or mistrust and the attitudes of African Americans towards research. The first is to build, again, on what's been said, and that is to challenge the primacy of the events at Tuskegee as the sole source of mistrust among African Americans. Dr. Vanessa Gamble, who is a physician and historian, and is actually one of the key figures who's responsible for President Clinton's apology for the government's role in the experiments, Dr. Gamble has written that problems involving the cultural mistrust between whites and blacks in this country predated public knowledge of the Public Health Service study. And she further states that there's a narrowness in our emphasizing, quote, a single historical event to explain deeply entrenched and complex attitudes within the black community. And as has been stated, experimentation on blacks did not start at Tuskegee. If we stay too focused on that one event, we may fail to look at the larger societal focus forces that have allowed such events to occur in the first place. My second and main point about the issue of trust in African Americans came from my reading of the medical and ethics literature on minority participation in research. This research often defers to this historical event, Tuskegee. And it makes such statements as, and I quote, minorities lack trust. Or they say that, quote, we need to cultivate trust in African Americans, suggesting that the problem is dispositional, that there's something about the inherent disposition of blacks related to mistrust. I'll concede that this dispositional mistrust does exist among some of us, and as Dr. Poussaint has eloquently said, it's certainly justified. But the point I want to raise is that such an analysis may actually serve to promote an unfair portrayal of African Americans. Identifying the locus of mistrust as existing within minorities, framing the issue as something that needs to be cultivated in them, unfairly shifts the burden away from the perpetrators and onto the victim. And furthermore, situating problems associated with trust outside of a more local institutional context, again referring to something that happened in the past, fails to recognize the influence of the here and now. Clinical encounters where patients directly experience actual untrustworthy situations, the many examples that Dr. Poussaint gave us, that's more likely to affect whether or not an African American is going to participate in a clinical trial than they're thinking about some historical event. If we want to improve minority participation in research, investigators must pay close attention to all the factors related to trust and their own trustworthiness, rather than locating the source of mistrust, as I've said, within minorities. I believe a more equitable stance would include reframing the problem as a breach of trust. This invites researchers to search for sources of untrustworthiness among their own practices and behaviors, as well as within their institutional structures. And research itself that serves to improve the health of minority individuals and communities will generally meet the standards of credibility. But those poorly designed studies, as the Tuskegee study was, those that are designed to reinforce negative or outdated notions of race or biological differences not only match the criteria of being untrustworthy, but they're also potentially dangerous in their capacity to perpetuate negative stereotypes. Finally, I think that research needs to be conducted always in a manner that conveys humanistic concerns, including compassion, empathy, and honesty. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Crowley and Dr. Evans, for getting our discussion started. I have a large number of questions here, so let's get started. I'm going to direct the first question to Dr. Poussant. And I'm sure it addresses a question that many of our audience are have on their mind. That is, where does the rest of the melting pot of America figure into this? There are many other racial ethnic groups, in particular Latinos and Asians. So is this just a black-white issue?
No, it's not just a black-white issue. I think... I talk mainly about African Americans tonight because that was my charge in relationship to the Tuskegee study. But I think this affects many different, if you look at the dominant group in terms of medicine and setting the cultural standards and styles, it's really been the white group by and large. And they're not monolithic either. They differ in styles and so on. But I think each of the, a lot of groups, Latinos, which is again a very heterogeneous group. I mean, you can't lump them all together. Asian American, I understand what that term means, but often it doesn't tell me too much. And right now at Harvard Medical School, we're trying to get them for people to put down what they are, not that they're Asian American, because it doesn't tell us much about them culturally or anything else. And in fact, it doesn't give us a database. If you came and asked us how many Indian students, South Asian Indian students, are in the freshman class or that we graduated in the last 5 years, I cannot retrieve that data because they, on the form, they have Asian American, which they check off. I can't tell you how many Chinese, but the cultural issues for all these groups are very different. That I think one of the problems that sometimes kind of makes some of the health providers feel overwhelmed is they say there's so many different cultural groups, and you want us to be culturally competent. How can we possibly do all of that, particularly when we only have 10 minutes to spend with them in the HMO? But I think there are styles and approaches, and I think there's background that can be introduced very early in the training of healthcare providers, physicians, and so on. There's very little in the curriculum at all about cultural competency. And I'm not talking about creating entirely new curriculums, but you can build it in. When you have clinical discussions on a patient with diabetes, well, Don, you better say something about the different rates of diabetes and issues in the black community and the Native American community and Latino community and how they handle them. You know, just all kinds of very important things. So, no, I think all of the different groups, including the different white immigrant groups, that we just all have to be alert. And then, you know, that I was up in Portland, Maine, and I'd speak at a local high school, and the high school, 52 different languages were spoken. Portland, Maine, you think of that as a white place. It is a white place. But they have designated Portland, Maine as a refugee center. Did you know that they do things like as a refugee center? So a lot of the refugees coming into the United States get sent to Portland, Maine. So they have people from all over, Bangladesh, Sudan, and so on and so forth, presenting a real challenge because of the language barriers and other things. So when we're talking about all of these, you know, different cultural things, remember there's also a social economic component in it as well, depending on, you know, class. And that, I think that's why we have to talk multicultural, and we have to do as much as we can and cover as many bases. But I think we also have to develop styles that we know will appeal to most people from different cultural groups, if the style is appropriate.
Thank you. Dr. Poussin alluded to the continued widespread disparities in healthcare. And while he didn't enunciate them, we know that they're related to cardiac services, cancer diagnostic services, psychiatric services, a whole range of services. And this question relates to, I'm going to direct this to Dr. Evans, has the HMO movement been good or bad for African Americans' health care in terms of access and quality?
Well, first of all, I'm not familiar with all the data in regards to HMOs, but in terms of managed care, I know one of the things, if you looked at how it was set up here in the state of California in terms of Medi-Cal managed care, one of the things that was done was that it was better not to see the patient than to see them, because you could get your capitation rate if you didn't see them. If you saw them more than three or four times in that month, you used up your capitation rate tremendously, and you lost money. So you have to look at it that way. And when I look at some of the studies that are coming out from the Medi-Cal managed care programs here in the state of California, it really hasn't shown it's made that much difference. It's pretty much the same, sort of somewhat flat. And because when you start looking at the HEDIS indicators, they're not that good. You know, they don't come across that well. Some areas do better than others, and some of the HEDIS indicators are better than others. And these HEDIS indicators are ways of trying to measure the type of care that's being provided. For example, they might measure immunization rates in two-year-olds. That's one of the HEDIS indicators. And whether or not they're really doing that much better, I don't see that really occurring yet. And perhaps they need more time in order to show that, though, because one of the things is that we have to get away from this immediate gratification type thing. The types of changes that Dr. Poussin talked about, when you start talking about 350 years of a problem, it's not going to go away overnight. It's going to take time for that to happen. And unfortunately, our government, which looks at, wants immediate gratification. If they don't get it, they're going to pull the funding away. That's what tends to happen. So I really can't answer that totally at this point in time.
Okay.
But it should be said, you know, I feel in the public health approach to all of this that frequently when public funds are given out for health problems, they're not given to the groups that need them the most. In other words, if you know that there's these disparities, then you should target them with the money. I mean, this could be part of reparations, who's, you know, whatever. But they need to target, you see, to make up for the wrongs and for the differences, and so to really make a difference. And if they do that, we might make more progress more rapidly. But frequently, it's just thrown into a pot with people fighting for it, and they're not targeted. You know, target people with the different groups. You would have to have a different target public health approach to Latinos and diabetes type 2 and blacks and diabetes type 2. You know what I mean? Because of the complexity. But yet, if we don't target them, we're in big trouble. We're already in big trouble around diabetes type 2.
We're going to need to move on because we have a stack of questions. You'll get another shot in a minute, Dr. Evans. The system has become particularly sophisticated in research methods and data analysis and in interpretation. Dr. Crowley, how can we or can we rule out racism as an integral part of the current research system?
The paradox of the paper that you mentioned, Dr. Evans, that Ms. Rivers had published, is that that study showed, the paper showed that there are some things we can do to make sure that racism doesn't occur in research. By the way, that paper can be found on the web at the Tuskegee Center for Bioethics website. If you did a search for Center for Bioethics and Tuskegee University, you'll get their website, and all those papers are actually available there. And I agree, I recommend that. I think that the key point is to have representation in research, that you don't do research on communities or on individuals, but you do research in participation, I mean, in combination and collaboration with individuals who you and the communities you're working with. Also, I think that it's important that the community become more informed about research and the research that's happening so that they are not subject to abuse. I work with the National Medical Association endeavor called IMPACT to improve minority participation in clinical trials. And our goal is to go around the country and to speak to audiences like this to tell you that it is important to be involved in research, but is incumbent upon you to become as aware as possible and to ask all the questions up front so that you are informed completely about that. I think that's the best safeguard we have against racism is an informed community.
Okay, I'll throw this out to anyone on the panel. The question is, don't you think that black people can blame themselves for their silence in not protecting their health or by changing bad habits and bad lifestyles? Don't everybody speak at the same time.
I'll say yes and no to begin with. One of the problems that occurs is that if the community has never been informed appropriately and to a level that they clearly understand in a language that they understand, then how can you blame them for not knowing? This was very true, as we have seen, in the AIDS epidemic. In San Francisco, there were $0 going out to any ethnic minority community back in 1986. $0. And we had we were beginning to see, and we had already seen AIDS cases in the African American community. It was not until 1987 that some dollars became available. But I dare say we have never had the level of prevention dollars to get out into the community that needs to get out there to make a real difference. So we really can't continue to blame ourselves for that. However, we have to realize we live in a world of tremendous technology and that we also have an obligation as an individual who wants to know to try to get more information. You can go to the public library and access the internet there for free. Many of us have computers in our home where we can access information. There are public libraries that are free. I think it's $1 for the card. And I'm sure that most of us who are sitting in here could afford the $1 for the card, to have a card for a year to go in and borrow books and sit down and read, and also to have discussion groups around issues that are pertinent to us. And I think one of the other things that has happened within that I've seen in terms of the African American community is the fact that we have been bombarded with so much negativity. I think we're turned off. You know, we have bad hypertension. We have bad child abuse. We have homicide rates that are off the chart. We have cancer rates that are off the chart. And we've heard that over and over again, and I think it really has turned us off. And I think one of the things that I would like to see happen is that we come in with a very positive campaign, and I'll bring this up to Grantley Johnson, who's sitting here, have a very positive health education campaign that takes the Surgeon General's prescription for a healthy lifestyle. And I would dare say let's add one other in there, and that is to develop a long-term trusting relationship with the healthcare provider. And I think that would go a long way to make a tremendous difference in the health disparities in this country for African Americans.
Okay. This is a more global question. How does our current war on terrorism affect what we could or should do to change, quote, the slave mentality? Dr. Poussin.
Who asked that question?
I want them to come see me privately. I don't know what that question means. Something skipped. You know, I don't know what the question means. So if I answer, I may answer the wrong thing. Something. Slave mentality and terrorism. I don't know. I decline.
Okay. Whoever asked the question can see Dr. Poussin afterwards. But don't see him in the dark. Here's another more global question before we begin to focus in on what are solutions. And that is, what are the implications of the Human Genome Project for addressing these disparities in healthcare, and particularly the question of cloning and race?
Well, if you're going to bring out, I'll let the women, but, people get kind of a eugenics notion, around cloning and you can make perfect human beings. And if racism exists, the people who are victimized are going to be left out of this. And they're also going to be looking, I have a hunch they're going to be looking for negatives. In other words, if they follow the path of the history of all these people, the physicians and psychologists are always looking for something inferior in black people, they're going to be looking for some genes. They're going to say, confirm we are less intelligent, all this other kind of stuff, or we're more susceptible. So I think there's some risk or dangers there, particularly if there's not the kind of representation, community involvement, government oversight, institutional review boards, and so on, looking at what people are doing. And then, they're not even obeying the rules, right? They say don't clone an embryo. They go out and clone an embryo. They say don't clone a human being. We may see 10 Nixons or something.
I think we have some other issues to deal with before the cloning, and just the simple issues such as selection, some of the other genetics issues that come up. And I think that we have a lot to learn in that we need to have watchdogs and we need to be alert as to what's happening and to make sure there's always participation from our community in these areas.
I take diabetes, say type 2. And let's say there's a genetic component, and black people have more of that genetic component inclination, and the Genome Project gets to all of that, and they get a way that they can, do gene therapy or something and cure type 2 diabetes, well, black people will benefit enormously. You see, so there's hope for ending disparities in healthcare insofar a lot of the things black people have, from the hypertension to the kidney stuff, there's some mysteries about it. And I don't think it's all just social economic and oppression. There may be other things going on that we may have to hear and listen to or discover.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we're about to run out of time and we can only take one more question. And I would ask this question to each of the panel members, starting with Dr. Crowley, then Dr. Evans, and ending with Dr. Poussin. And it's, where should we focus our efforts as we attempt to improve the health status of African Americans and reduce health disparities? Dr. Crowley.
I think I want to focus that question back to the Public Health Service study and the implications of that for us. As I had mentioned, I call it the U.S. Public Health Service study, and I don't call it the Tuskegee study because I think it's a very slight, very subtle, but very important to make, and it's what I tried to speak to earlier, and that is really focusing on the perpetrator and not the victim, to not question the Tuskegee University, the veneration that we should hold that institution, and not sully it by calling it the study, but actually focusing it back on the perpetrator, which was the Public Health Service at that point in time. And I would say that the significance of that is that we will always stay alert to the issues of who needs to be looked at, who is trustworthy, who is not. That would be my recommendation.
I would say to deal with the disparities that occur in the African-American community, we're really going to have to target at a community-based level.
Because if we don't do that, we're never going to make any difference whatsoever. Just trying to do an individual type thing is not going to work. We need community-based and community involvement in order to make a real difference.
I think one thing that will help a great deal is if we get universal health insurance of some type. Because the economic barriers are still severe and minorities are disproportionately represented. I think there has to be more access in the community and availability of health services are there. And I don't mean just buildings. I mean the whole way that the health center or the community centers approach the community. I think because blacks and other minority groups have felt rejected, we have to do things to make them feel welcome, to make them feel that this is part of their community institution, just like the church. You see what I mean? And it's there to serve them. The other thing I think that we have to carry on a lot of educational programs, targeting different groups, black community, Latino community, and so on, to make it. Then I think there is such a thing as cultural competence, or ending discrimination, unconscious or conscious, from healthcare providers toward patients. And they do have those problems, and the studies verify that. So I think the cultural competence issue, anywhere you want to find it, has to be built into the system as well. Finally, I think we need more healthcare providers for more and more different ethnic groups, more African Americans, Latinos, and so on, because we know that those people tend to serve their populations, but it's also important that they're up there doing the research, they're up there making policy, and they're up there just being there, because when I walk in and I see a black person, I feel better. And I feel more trusting. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Poussin. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, the California Healthcare Foundation, the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society, UCSF Center for Health and Community, and the San Francisco Department of Public Health's African American Health Initiative, I would like to thank our distinguished keynote speaker, Dr. Alvin Poussin. Thanks also to both of our terrific discussants, Dr. Patricia Evans and Dr. Vera Crawler. And finally, thanks as well to all of our listeners, those of you who are here in the audience, as well as those listening on the radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Washington.